Shada Soleimani lives with injured birds, but she doesn't keep them as captive pets. She nurses them back to health with the intention of freeing them. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Birds are featured in some of the work in her exhibition, What a Revolutionary Must Know, that's now on view at the Contemporary Arts Center. But more importantly, the story of her parents' freedom is featured too. She joins me in this recorded interview to discuss her exhibition. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
There is so much of your parents' story in your work. Can you tell us a bit about their life in Iran and their imprisonment?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a story that I grew up with. And I grew up here in like the Cincinnati metro area, a little outside of Loveland, before it was very developed. And they were, you know, very open about their history and their lives with me as I was growing up. And so, you know, I very much was like attuned to the stories and like the trauma that they experienced at the hands of a dictatorial regime. And when I started going to school here, I realized that these aren't stories that are common, at least not in Ohio.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of just made me start telling their stories, you know, like talking about my parents were pro-democracy revolutionaries in Iran. And they were, you know, against the Shah's regime and against the Ayatollahs. A lot of people, when they think about the Cultural Revolution in 1979, realized that the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollah came into power. But a lot of people are like, oh, the Shah was good, right? And he absolutely was not. It's just another form of evil.
Mm. And then they were both imprisoned during their time there, right?
They were at separate times. So my father was very active. He gave a lot of speeches. He was part of an underground kind of movement in which he was distributing revolutionary leftist material. And because of his speeches and because of his, like, you know, programming in the party, he was persecuted and he had a bounty on his head. So he had to go into hiding. He was arrested once and was able to be released. But then that's after he was imprisoned, he was like, okay, I have to go into hiding now because my life's in danger. My mother, my father escaped over the mountains on horseback, 2-week journey across the border of Iran to Turkey. And he escaped before my mother did. When my mother attempted to escape, she was caught at the border and she was put into solitary confinement for over a year.
Oh, how did they endure that separation from each other?
I mean, I think they just had to. It was the only way they could. So my father, you know, after he crossed the border, he was able to get into Turkey, seek political asylum. He actually had to show proof that his life was at risk. So he had a clipping of a newspaper from Ruznameh-i Kayhan, which is like the daily newspaper that actually showed that there was a bounty on his head. And he had to show that to the border, you know, kind of agents to be like, this is the proof that my life is in jeopardy. He was in Turkey for over a year, kind of getting his bearings before he was able to get to Italy and then the States. At that time, my mom was in solitary and their amount of contact was just none. You know, there was this hope that they would find each other. There were letters that were written. Segments of those letters are actually in the exhibition. But there was really just kind of fragmented communication during that time. And then when she finally got out, there was this correspondence that they were doing by mail for over a year.
Your father drew a map of his escape route. Tell us about that and how you've used it in your work.
So I'm really interested in, like, you know, most people when they go into an exhibition, they're just expecting to see art on white walls. And I'm not interested in, you know, just showing something as simple as that. I like to build environments. I like to build worlds. And part of world building is kind of thinking about, you know, presenting everything in a scene or a story. And so the walls of the exhibition are always in this series of work covered with their drawings, whether it be in this exhibition of the CAC, it's a drawing that my mother did of the border crossing, an exhibition I just had at New York City. There was the exhibition of my father's escape route and map. And so drawing was a really important thing or a way for them to communicate with me what happened to them. I remember being a little kid and going to like the fancy restaurant, which was Olive Garden, and there'd be a paper tablecloth and they would bring me, the kid, some crayons. And my mom and my dad would always, mostly my mom, would take the crayons and she would make these drawings. And sometimes they'd be of her solitary confinement cell. Sometimes they would be of deceased babies that she delivered, stillborn babies she delivered in a Kurdish field hospital. My father would draw his escape route. And so these were really just common stories for me, and thinking about the layering of these histories, it made me really feel like they should be included in building the world of the exhibition.
Yeah. You grew up, as you said, in Greater Cincinnati, kind of in the Loveland area before it was what it is now,
yeah.
Without other kids from the greater Southwest Asian or North African region.
That's right.
How do you address that or discuss that in your work?
I think there's a lot of blind spots in Western education and public school systems. You know, when we're talking about non-Western history, like no one knew about what happened in Iran and the Cultural Revolution. There's always this just kind of like lump. I'm like, really appreciate that you use SWANA instead of Middle East, you know, because even that is a huge blind spot. Thinking about political histories that are non-Western was just something that I grew up knowing because my parents talked about it, but kids that I grew up with didn't. After, you know, 9/11, the amount of racism that we faced, people thought that, you know, we were terrorists. I remember, you know, going to school and kids being like, oh, so does your dad know Saddam Hussein? And I would talk to my dad and my dad would be like, Shada, you know, one thing you have to do when you face people that are ignorant is to use humor because that's the only way you could get over it. So he told me to tell them that he played backgammon with Saddam because, of course, Persians don't play chess. They play backgammon. So I would go to school and I'd be like, yeah, my Baba plays backgammon with Saddam Hussein. And kids would just, you know, believe it. And it's like the lack of education was a huge part of why I make work about what I do.
How old were you when you were going through all that?
9, 10. Yeah, I was 10. Wow. I mean, like there was racism before that. You know, my mom has a darker complexion. We grew up in like corn and soybean fields. And I remember we'd go to like the Kroger and people would kind of follow us around, think that I was like adopted. They would say things to her, like go back to where you came from. So, yeah.
Talk about the fugitive stories you tell in your work.
I mean, there's so many stories of individuals, especially individuals under totalitarian dictatorships like those in Iran that are not told. You know, I tell the stories of my parents because their stories, I mean, while they're unique, are not rare. If we think about the amount of people, especially if you're looking at what happened at Zan Zendegi Azadi, the woman life freedom movement in Iran after Mahsa Zina Amini's death, you'll see how much is suppressed. There are so many stories that cannot leave the country. And I'm really interested in survivor testimony and fugitive stories as like a form of, you know, communicating with individuals that might not have access to these things, that these people exist and their stories need to be told.
I'm talking with artist Shada Soleimani about her art and her work rescuing injured birds. Her solo exhibition, What a Revolutionary Must Know, is open now and running through January 25th at the Contemporary Arts Center. Shada, your mother used to tell you bedtime stories drawn from Persian folklore. What images did you draw in your mind while you were hearing those?
Well, some of it was from Persian folklore, but most of my bedtime stories, I would say, were about her time working in a Kurdish field hospital or the things that she experienced. So I remember one of my bedtime stories was her telling me about a leper asylum that she worked at, and she would talk about leprosy as a disease. I didn't know what leprosy was, so I would ask her, you know, what's leprosy? And she would say, oh, it's when your skin necroses and falls off. And I would be like, well, what's necrosis? And she'd be like, oh, it's when your flesh, like, dies and, like, you know, and so I'd be like, dies, like, it must turn black and fall off. So for the longest time as a little kid, I was afraid that instead of, like, the boogeyman, like, hanging out under my bed, that leprosy was hiding under my bed. And there was, like, this man with, like, this rotting nose that would, like, sneeze and his nose would fall in his hands or something. Those were kind of woven in with fairy tales. I'm, you know, not all of my bedtime stories were traumatic.
Like, I was going to say she wanted you to sleep, right?
You know, I don't think there was much of a filter. I think people that have experienced that amount of trauma and haven't gone to therapy, you know, just find storytelling as a way of communicating what happened to them. And so I'm happy, you know, that she was able to communicate with me. I think it taught me so much about the world that I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, it's certainly about her.
Yeah.
In your Ghostwriter series, you convey your parents' biographies through your art. How did you collaborate with them on that?
Well, it's really important that it's collaborative, actually. It was one of the conditions of making the work. When I started Ghostwriter, it was the end of 2021. The pandemic had started. My father's an essential worker. He's a doctor. And I'm a disaster thinker. So I was convinced that they were going to die.
Oh.
And, you know, when I was a kid, my father would always say, Shada Baba, like, I want to find someone to ghostwrite a book about our story. And I was like, okay, whatever, Dad. Like, we'll see. And it never happened. So when I was convinced that we were all going to die during the pandemic, I called them up and I was like, hey, can I ghostwrite your story? And they said, yes, under three conditions. One, our faces are covered. Two, we discuss any of the work that you're making. And three, it's collaborative. And the collaboration has been really just like one of the most incredible experiences of my life. It might be me coming up with an idea and being like, okay, here's my idea for the piece. I'll call them and tell them. And they'll say, okay, this sounds okay, but tweak this. That date's not right. You know, I think you're like accentuating this too much. And so we collaborate. Then I start building the sets. And then they actually come into the studio. And when they come into the studio, it is really playful and really collaborative. My mom will pose my dad and say, sit like this, or no, do this. And my dad will just be like, okay, no, you go over there. I'm, you know, it's just like, it's very directorial. It's very playful. It feels like we're in this kind of funny little like collaborative play set together.
Yeah. Like family.
Yeah. Just like family. Well, some of them, I guess.
Well, you mentioned concealing your parents' faces. Why was that so important?
There's a few reasons. I mean, A, my father is still, you know, politically active in many ways, and protecting his identity is extremely important for me. The second is because photography is actually a really racist medium, if you think about it. The history of photography is dominated by colonialism, by white men that go out into the field and take photographs, capture photographs of the other. And then when we're looking at photographs, I really think a lot about Alan Sekulow's text, Body in the Archive. And we think about when we look at images of people, we're stereotyping them based off of what we know or understand. What's the shape of their face? What are they wearing? What's their race? What's their supposed gender? And how can we assign identity to them? And I really wanted to protect my parents from that. You know, thinking about telling their stories, them being the vehicles for the story and the people that the survivor testimony, without having to actually show people their faces. The expectation that people have of portraiture to be able to have access to someone's face, I think is, you know, an assumption or something, an expectation that we shouldn't have when we're viewing images of people.
Especially people who've been through such trauma. I think you've referred to it as the pornography of pain.
Exactly.
And I've heard that referred to in reference to poverty too, the pornography of poverty. And then you can end up re-traumatizing. I mean, does that part of the thinking that goes into what you're doing there?
100%. I think these are the problems with photojournalistic images, actually. When we're looking at traumatic situations in which people are brutalized in some way, shape, or form, and we're like, oh my God, now we have access to their story, and now we can consume it. These aren't stories meant to be consumed. You know, I really believe in oral histories to share these stories, but I really believe that, you know, they need to be done in a consensual way. And so through collaborating and not exploiting, you know, their stories as this kind of way to capture people's attention because it's so crazy to them is really important to me.
So you do not think of your photographs as documentary images. There's something else?
I don't know. I'm really interested in magical realism as a, you know, genre in literature. I mean, I think Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude is kind of a touchstone piece that a lot of people know. But he's doing something in that, and a lot of magical realist writers are, in which they're scrambling time. The past goes to the future, goes to the present, goes back to the past. And that's a political choice because we're so expecting things to be linear. And when people come into my exhibitions, they're like, okay, so where does it start? And there is no start and there is no ending because there's this kind of cycle of just jumping around. And that's what these types of histories are.
You kind of see that stylistically in your work, this scrambling of time because of these environments you create, that you photograph, and your subjects, they almost have a collage effect. Is that really intentional, or those choices that you really think about?
Absolutely. I think a lot about Dada collage, Hannah Hawk, as like, you know, this figure that took the faces of politicians and mechanized them and made them into these kind of cyborgs. What does it mean? Even like collage, like comes from the French coller, to cut, right? And cutting is actually a really violent act. What does it mean to take images that are whole and to fragment them and to splice them back together? And there's a lot about like being an immigrant or being diasporic that's like a patchwork, like creating this kind of patchwork of life. But if you're also thinking about Dada collage and mechanizing these bodies and creating these cyborgs, it's also like a political choice to be cutting and pasting and fragmenting. And I'm really interested in doing that. You know, the kind of opposite of the type of photography that goes into the world and captures an image. I'm interested in building like what I like to call a consensual photographic practice, where I'm building or I'm collaging in collaboration with the lens, and the lens isn't capturing or penetrating, but it's an an active participant.
You learned to care for wounded wild creatures from your mom, right? How did she teach you?
Well, so she was a nurse back in Iran, and caretaking was like the truest joy of her life. She talked about it all the time when I was growing up. She talked about working in the field hospital and how she would make her patients happy and a lot of the traumatic things that she saw. You know, as a nurse working in a guerrilla field hospital, there were a lot of awful things she saw. And when she came to the States, she could no longer practice nursing. You know, she was very traumatized. She wasn't able to speak English as well. And so she really lost like one of her true loves. We grew up in, you know, kind of off of State Route 48. So like corn and soy fields. And, you know, I think a lot of people's favorite pastimes was hitting animals for fun.
Oh.
Roadkill was, you know, something that my mom and my dad and I would drive past. And, you know, you'd find these things that were half dead, half alive. And she would bring them into the car and she'd bring them home. My father would bring home some stuff from work. He's a doctor. And our kitchen island kind of became this like surgical suite for these random animals. I grew up with baby raccoons, you know, that my mom would care for as a rehabilitator. I don't recommend you do that. It's illegal unless you're licensed. Yeah. And birds that she would bring into the house. And when they would die, she would show me their bodies and she would stretch out their wings and show me their anatomy and be like, you know, don't be scared of death. This is something that's going to happen to all of us, but you should learn how to take care of these things or care for them. And that was really something she instilled in me at a very young age.
Such powerful lessons. You mentioned raccoons. Tell us about the rescued raccoon. I understand there was one that slept in your hair when you were 5 years
yeah.
old.
I mean, you know, rehab is very different now than it was in the 90s. You know, I have to say this, like, yes, I grew up with a raccoon, like, sleeping in my hair. Raccoons are rabies vector species. They are not meant to be kept as pets. It's illegal. The only reason this happened was because my mother was a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. But, you know, it was something that, like, instilled that kind of passion in me because that raccoon was not habituated. As it grew up, it came into its wild instincts and it was released back into the wild where it belongs. Wild animals are not meant to be toys or pets for us, but they're meant to exist, you know, freely in the wild. And that was a huge lesson for me. Even though I got to like share a close space with these things, it was really important watching them become more independent and have these kind of wild behaviors.
And that's what you do with birds now at your home, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
So in the state of Rhode Island, I am the only or one of the only federally licensed wild bird rehabilitators. And I own and found and operate a whole entire wild bird clinic where we intake over 2,000 birds every year that come in injured or harmed because of human-caused infrastructure. And we actually take from a lot of other states. We take from Massachusetts, Connecticut. I've even had birds driven up from New York City. We just had an Atlantic puffin that was blown off course that spent time in our rehab clinic and was just released. So yeah, it's like for me, it's not just a hobby or a passion project, but it's part of my way of life. It's part of a building of worlds. And that kind of intertwines with what I do as an artist, with what I do as a professor. You know, it's just one of three things.
Is it, does it give you some self-care?
I mean, so at first when I started doing the, I guess, quote unquote bird thing, I just moved to Rhode Island. I started teaching. I did not realize that academia would be so incredibly draining, especially as a young woman of color. You know, I was 25 when I started teaching and I was just like so overwhelmed. And I remember I went to therapy for the first time in my life and my therapist asked me what made me happy. And I remember telling her, well, like, I've always, you know, my mom and I always worked with animals and that made me really happy. And she's like, okay, well, why don't you find a rehabilitation clinic to start volunteering at? And I did start volunteering like the next week. And I was like, wow, I missed this. But I realized that I didn't want to do it at someone else's like center as like a volunteer. You know, the amount, there were no bird rehabilitators in the state at the time. They had retired like or passed away. And I was like, everyone loves the fuzzy squirrels and raccoons, but people don't really want to understand birds. You know, they're kind of overlooked. And unless you're a birder, it's becoming trendier now, which I'm very happy for. And so I started rehabilitating birds in Rhode Island. I did it here in Cincinnati when I was a college student. People lovingly referred to me as the bird girl and would bring me birds in boxes to my apartment in Clifton. And I'd rehabilitate them in my, you know, bathroom and release them off the top of my gallery in Brighton. But you know, finding something like that in Rhode Island was a form of self-care. And it still is. It's extremely devastating work. 70% of the patients that come into us are so harmed beyond repair that I actually have to euthanize them. Mm. But that's a really just big like gift that you can give if something's in pain. So even though it's hard to watch and hard to do, it's kind of like this drug, like releasing these birds is like one of the best feelings in the world. Mm-hmm. Seeing them fly free is incredible.
Yeah. There's so much humor and playfulness in your artwork. How do you achieve that and why is that important to you?
It's a coping mechanism. You know, like just like my father telling me to go tell kids that, you know, Saddam Hussein was his backgammon, you know, opponent. After Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by Trump in 2020, I got an outpouring of text messages of people saying, Shayna, I'm so sorry for your family. And I was like, what? People actually think that because we have the same last name, we're related. And so I always do this kind of joke. I was like, thank you so much. You know, he was a really great uncle, you know? And so it just goes right over people's heads, but it helps me cope because I think the lack of education is really just, I see it every day and it doesn't surprise me anymore, but I'm really interested in Trojan horses. Can you use humor or seduction in a way to invite someone into a difficult topic, especially now? Like, we are in a media saturated economy. We're constantly scrolling on our phones. We're seeing images of brutalized bodies that are starving or harmed, and it's really hard to look at. And is there a way to talk about those difficult things without traumatizing our viewers? You know, some people think trauma is necessary to learn, but it's also something that makes people shut off. They're like, oh, I can't engage with this anymore. I need to like watch something mindless, or I need to watch like, you know, reality TV to get over it. And if there's a way to use humor or use something beautiful to invite people into wondering or asking questions about things that are difficult, you know, that's what I'm interested in.
Your father sang a revolutionary anthem to you when you were a child, and it included imagery of a red tulip. Can you tell us about the anthem and maybe recite some of it for us?
So, Aftab Kerana Jangal is a revolutionary anthem from, I think, 1952, when Mossadegh was a democratically elected overthrown official. I actually sang it for show and tell once when I was a kid. Obviously, no one understood it. But it's talking about, you know, tulips are originally a leftist revolutionary symbol in Iran. And so if you think about tulips, they bloom in the spring, and then when they die back, they die. But underground, those bulbs are actually multiplying. And so when they come back the next year, there's more of them. And so they are the symbol of resistance in this anthem. You know, they say in the mountains, you know, the tulips come back year after year after year, and they grow in force. And so that's really the power of being a revolutionary, is that it might be slow and it might take time, but the momentum will grow.
Well, I've been talking with artist Shayna Soleimani. Her solo exhibition, What a Revolutionary Must Know, is now open and runs through January 25th at the Contemporary Arts Center in downtown Cincinnati. Shayna, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
It's been lovely being here. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors are Stephen Baum and Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.